All right. Good evening. And tonight we have another special guest. We will be meeting with Coach Tonja Buford Bailey. Ashley, thank you for joining us again as well. So before we get started, let me run down Coach Tonja's resume really quickly. It's kind of long, so it may take me a second here. First, you are known as the University of Illinois' greatest female athlete. That's pretty big.
Okay.
And
you still got that title.
You were the Illini's most outstanding athlete from 1990 to 93. So in high school, four-time state champ. So you were nice in high school, of course. And in college, 10-time All-American, Big Ten Athlete of the Year four times. In 92, you won four events at the Big Ten meet, the 100, the 100 hurdles, the four hurdles, and you won the winning relay. Was that the 4x4 or the 4x1?
I won five events.
Five events. Oh, I'm sorry. It's okay. What's your event?
That year, I didn't run 400 hurdles. I ran the one and the two, the 100 hurdles, and both of the relays.
So you pretty much won the conference championship.
My coach, he mixed it up so we could get points. You know, he mixed it up.
That's a lot of points, especially you winning everything.
Tanya Williams ran and won the 400 hurdles.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, your teammate Tanya.
Yeah, so, my teammate.
So you guys
ended up winning the Big Ten champs that year.
Okay. Yeah. Hold on. Let me finish. You still have a lot of stuff here. So NCAA champion in 92 in the 400 hurdles. You're a three-time Olympian. In 95, you were a world championship silver medalist in the four hurdles with a time of 52.62, which at the time that actually was faster than the world record. Amazing. 96, you got an Olympic bronze in the 400 hurdles, and your time of 52.62 is actually currently still number seven all time, so still one of the best ever. On to your coaching career. Two times Midwest region head women's coach of the year, 25 Big Ten individual and relay titles, a member of the 2012 Olympic team coaching staff, 2016 USATF Nike coach of the year while at Texas, becoming the first female to be honored since the inception of the award in 1998, and through your career coaching a number of All-Americans and national champions, including Courtney Okolo, the reigning indoor 400-meter champion and world record holder on the mixed relay. Whew. Oh, four-time Olympic medalist coach as well, with two golds, a silver, and a bronze. That's a resume. I mean, that took a while. A very impressive coach. Go ahead.
It's Women's History Month, so it's good to know that we have the first female Nike honored coach. So that's impressive as well.
Absolutely.
Thank you, guys. I think you mentioned the 25 Big Ten championships. That was as an athlete, not a coach.
Oh. I'm sorry. It was just also, it was so much. I'm probably sure I missed some accolades.
I don't think I had 25 Big Ten. I don't know.
On that. Are you sure?
We had a lot, though.
We had a lot, but yeah, I don't know.
You may have. I don't know. So
I don't know.
And like I was mentioning, you asked me before, we actually have met before. I actually got my coaching career started at Illinois as a volunteer. I volunteered there for a few months while you were there. And we met just
who was the
briefly.
Head coach?
I was volunteering for Wayne Angel.
Wayne. Mm-hmm. Got
yep,
it.
Yep. So I was there for a few months with my old coach, Charles Goffin. I don't know if you remember that guy.
Oh, he told me. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Cool. Yeah.
Interesting character.
Hey, Champaign is a cool place, isn't it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
You don't think so? No,
I liked
Champaign
it.
Is people are asleep on how Champaign is a very nice city.
It's a very nice town.
I enjoyed it.
It's close proximity to other big cities, so you can always get a little mixture of hometown stuff and then drive an hour or so.
Drive to Chicago, Indianapolis, St. Louis.
Yeah. So you're the best of both worlds for sure.
I enjoyed it. It was a little cold, kind of like Ithaca. But, you know, and I was volunteering at the time, so I kind of was broke. So, I mean, that kind of affected my enjoyment of the
area. Yeah, you're never happy when you're broke. Sorry.
Exactly. So how'd you get
circumstances?
Yeah. But that was the start of my coaching career, volunteering at Illinois. So it was pretty cool being there for the short time that I was there and getting to work with some of the really good athletes that I got to work with that short time there.
Mm-hmm.
So how'd you get started in track? You were, you know, obviously you were kicking butt in high school, but when did it start for you?
I started running when I was 8.
Okay, wow.
AAU, USA, TAC was what it used to be called at the Track Athletics Congress, way before, you know, the fancy names. But yeah, I started when I was 8, really just running on the playground, kind of noticed I was faster than other kids. And then I remember one day sitting in class, maybe second grade or something, and they announced, you know, like at the end of the day, they have all the announcements. And they mentioned that there was a track club. And I was like, wait a minute, you can actually do this organized? And so that was a big deal. And I took the flyer and I took it home and was begging my mother and father. And they was like, it costs $20. And I'm like, oh man, please, you gotta hook us up. You know, me and my little sister, we started, I was 8, she was 7. And that's really where we started. And I was on a really good club team. So by the time I was like 9 and 10, we were starting to do national level stuff on relays.
Oh, so that early. Okay. So it got a little bit of travel to different places.
I wasn't a national level. I don't know if I was a national level athlete at that age. I know, you know, we were functioning well, but but in terms of like going to nationals and stuff, it would mainly be on relays back when I was younger. Cause my coach didn't really, you know, if you went until you were like high school, he really didn't like you to do a lot of individual national stuff. He liked you to kind of earn your way on relays, which I think is actually kind of cool because it takes the pressure off of, you know, you really young athletes. So that was kind of cool. Now that I look back, I didn't realize it at the time, but it was
great. That's a great point. Absolutely.
And in high school, did you know that you were good? Because you said that you were beating the other kids and everything, but did you actually know that you had the talent, or did you just still see it as just something that was fun?
No, like I started hurdling. I had that late birthday. So my birthday's in December. So I was always at the bottom of the age group running against older girls. Mm-hmm. So I always thought it was a negative back then because I was never at the top of my age group. And I'm like, man, if I was the top of my age group, I'd be doing this, you know. So, but I was able to start hurdling early because I think you could start at age 12, 13. So I was like 11 starting hurdles and just kind of figuring that out. But no, actually what happened to me is I started doing 200 hurdles and then 400 hurdles. And actually in Syracuse, New York, I ran this 400 hurdle race. And I ran really, 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 really fast. And it was like an age group record and everything at the time. I was 14. So I think I was 13 running in. No, I was 14 running in the 15, 16 age group. And that was one of the things that actually made me end up not running the race at a higher level, because I was kind of like chasing this. I think I ran like a 59 or a 60 something when I was that young. Mm-hmm. And I could never run faster than that. Right. So that was going into high school. Then I went into high school and I started running 300 hurdles and I started doing well in 100 hurdles. And then every time I ran 400 hurdles, I would run slower than I was when I was, you know, 14. And then I became 17 and I couldn't run as fast as I was when I was 14. And then I was 19 and I couldn't run as fast as I was when I was 14. And I'm just like, this is debilitating. Like, it was mentally debilitating for me. So I just got to the point where I was like, I don't ever want to run 400 hurdles anymore. I'm a short hurdler. I'm a sprinter. And, you know, my coach came to me, Gary Winkler, who was my college coach and professional coach. And he was just like, you're a 400 hurdler. So pretty much that's what you're going to do. That's what you're going to be great in. Like, he like told me, he knew, he was like, this is what you're going to be great in. We have to figure it out. And so my freshman year, I was playing the con game. Hey, if I can score really high in the 200 at Big Ten, can I not have to run the 400 hurdles? If I do this in 100 hurdles, can I not have to run the 400 hurdles? And I mean, I was running that event and it was horrible. Like, it was making me not even want to go to track meets. This is in college. And I was running very well in college. I was a 10 champ in 100 meters, second in the conference in the two. I was the only freshman to make nationals that year in the 100 hurdles as a freshman. But I had this monkey on my back about the 400 hurdles. So I had thought I had worked my way out of that after freshman year. I come back sophomore year and my coach had a meeting with me and he was like, you either going to run 400 hurdles or you can And but that's how it was back then. You know, you didn't like negotiate with athletes and stuff.
No, back then.
Like, I'm the best one on the team, and my coach trying to get rid of me. You know, but I understood it, and I really trusted him. So I knew, like, he knew what he was doing, and I knew that it was something that I just had to figure out. So my sophomore year, I really started saying, "Let me try to really pay attention and figure out what is happening here, because I know I'm a better athlete." And so once I really figured out the rhythm of the race and understood what I was supposed to be doing with my arms and all, because I was a great hurdler, but it was that other part of it. And then just one race, it just clicked. And once I ran, like, because I was running like 60s and 61s and 62s, and I was doing great in all these other events. And then just one race, I ran like a 57 low. So it was like a huge 3 or 4 second improvement. And once I did that, it was over. I was like, oh, I'm good now. And that became the event that I focused on the most. And same year I made Pan Am Games and got a medal at Pan Am Games in the event that I really refused to run.
yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, a lot of folks, they start track early because you started track at a pretty young age. And then you see some folks who they were really good, and then they hit that wall where they don't see improvement. And it sounds like in that one event, you were having a hard time where you just weren't able to run faster in that event. What do you mainly attribute that to?
Well, you know, I'll answer that two ways. One, what you mentioned about starting young, I did start young, but like I mentioned, the reason that I never got burnt out is because there was no pressure on me when I was a young athlete. Like, we ran everything. We ran hurdles. I ran the one, I ran the two, the four. I ran the eight a couple times, which I wasn't good at. I ran cross country, like, you know, just everything. And there was never a time where I was, never specialized. And there was and I played basketball and stuff, but there was never a point where I felt like, as a young athlete, that there was any pressure for me to win or run fast or think about times or anything like that when I was young, ever. I don't ever remember even being concerned about what place I finished or time until deep into high school. Okay. So that was for me and my experience. To answer the other question is, As track runners, we get so focused on the clock. And so the problem that I was having with that event was, I had this time. It wasn't the event that was the monkey on my back. It was that mark and that time that I felt like every single time that I ran and I didn't achieve that I was a failure, right? So I could do all these other things and feel like I wasn't a failure, but I do this one thing. And if I didn't run, it didn't matter if I won or whatever, because I was winning some 400 hurdles, but I always felt like a failure. And it was easier for me, like it is for most human beings, to avoid things that you know you're not going to do well at, right? Mm-hmm. Because no one wants to feel like a failure. So it took years and years and years and years and years for me to kind of get that out of my head, until I just said, okay, I am forced to do it. My back is up against the wall, so I have to make it work, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there are a lot of athletes that do run into that. And then you even have, at the next level, athletes who run really well in college. Well, now they're professionals. And I'll tell you, there's something about college track that you're running every weekend. You're sharp. You're kind of in a bubble in the fact that your life is being controlled, right? That is the easiest way to be successful, is to have someone else control your life, right? So then you become a professional and it seems so much harder. Everything that you thought seemed easy seems so much harder, but it's not. It actually was really hard when you were a college runner. You were always up against the gun because the competition is so tough. You're running week in and week out, which means you're getting a lot of races. You're very sharp. And then your life is controlled. Someone tells you when to be at every place at what time. And then you're also balancing that with the education side of it. So to put in perspective, it's a lot easier. It's a lot harder to be a college athlete than it is to be a professional athlete. But I just don't think that sometimes the professional athletes put as much focus in the one thing, which is the priority is track and field, right? So when you're in college, you can't get away from the priority because the priority is right there. And then it's scheduled for you, right? So you're not really able to be distracted as much as you are when that's not all you're doing. So so then you have professionals that really struggle with why aren't I running as fast as I was running in college, right? Mm-hmm. And then when you start to put that, I'm older, I'm faster, I have a professional coach, all these things that go through your head, like I should be better. And really just go back to the basics. You know, what helped you? So my coach always coached me like a college athlete. Like that's the schedule we went off of, you know, tried to race me as much as possible. We start training when the college kids started training, you know, just kind of stay on that schedule and instead of, so I kind of coach that way too. Now I'm like, let's follow the collegiate pattern, because not only is a great pattern for the sport, but it's also something that you're familiar with that you've been successful with. So why try to reinvent the wheel, you know? So I think sometimes when people are young and they run really fast, they get caught up into the pressure now of having to really beat yourself.
Mm-hmm. And as a coach, did you encounter
this? Constantly trying to beat yourself and beat the current time that you're going after. So how did you change your perspective while you were going from the 100 hurdles, the 200, et cetera, to the 400 hurdles? Because you made the Olympic team while you were in college as well.
Yeah, so that's kind of funny because I told you that sophomore year was kind of like the breakthrough year. I did qualify for Pan Ams and World Student Games, ran well there. And then the next year, of course, I came in with a totally different mentality. First of all, I needed to lose weight. That's just a fact. So that was one of the things I really started focusing on at the beginning of fall training. And then by the time the season progressed, of course, I had more opportunities to run the race because, like I said, in college, you get to run every weekend. So I had more opportunities to run the race to kind of refine my skills there. And then going into the NCAA meet, which happened to be in Austin, Texas that year in 1992, I just kind of ran my way through the rounds, right? Like I didn't go in as a favorite or anything, but just kind of each round got better and better. And I was like, okay, until got to the point where it's so funny because Quincy Watts, you guys know who he is, right? Mm-hmm. So he ran the 400 right before my event went off. And like, he killed it, broke the collegiate record by like 43:50. I'm a statistician, so I can throw numbers up. But anyway, he ran like 43:50 and I was like, oh, okay, we're running today. And then he was like, he said something to me like, you're next. And I was like, you're right, I'm next. You know, that was it. So I was like, hype. So I went and after I won that, then I was like, okay, well, going to Olympic trials. And again, that was for experience, just kind of, you know, have that experience of going to the trials. And because it was so funny, you know, they announced where the Olympics is going to be probably 5 years before because the whole city is bidding and whatever, right? So we know where the next Olympics is going to be now, right? So, and this was maybe 92 and they had announced that in 96 was going to be Atlanta. And I was devastated because I hadn't really gone out of the country month. And I'm like, no, you know, when you think of the Olympics, you think of these exotic cities, you know, Seoul and Tokyo. And I was like, I want to go somewhere fancy when I go to the Olympics, you know, because in that you're already, you know, claiming it. Like, I know I'm going to be on the 96 team. So I wanted to go somewhere fancy. I'm mad that it's in Atlanta. I done been to Atlanta, blah, blah, blah. And so that year, I'm thinking I'm just going to the trials to have some fun, learn some things. And again, each round, I was just setting myself up in a good position, going through the semi, setting myself up in a good position, having a good lane in the final. And then at that, you just run for it and snuck up and got second. So that wasn't something that was really, you know, expected or going in like, oh, I'm trying to make this team. I really was just going in there to learn some things. So, you know, again, I think the less pressure you put on yourself, the better you are, right? Because you can't force something to happen. So just be as prepared as possible and, you know, do what comes naturally for you, but don't put this enormous amount of pressure on your back to for a certain thing to happen because you really can't control it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but that definitely was, attests to
in, college was cool because, like I said, I think it did help me for the ones to come down the road. So
I think that your story attests to when preparation meets opportunity and you just let it happen as opposed to just like forcing something to happen, because your greatest times in high school and in college and making the Olympic team was there's no pressure on yourself. You didn't have any target on your back or anything. You were just going in there to just do what you had to do. And you were prepared for greatness, as you can see. Mm-hmm. How do you explain or talk about that to your athletes? Having them to explain, you know, don't put too much pressure on yourself. We do what we do in practice, and, you know, certain things should just happen.
It's hard, but I think the easiest way for them to see it is to do it, right? So you have to model a lot in training what you're going to do in the race, but I think you also have to race a lot too. So I think where we are now is we've missed a lot of racing opportunities with COVID. So you missed almost a whole, there's never a time, unless you're injured or something like that, where you don't have a really good full season the year before the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. Right. So, so that really hurt. So, you know, we were coming off of 2019 and it was supposed to be 2020. Well, now we're going into an Olympic year where we really didn't even race last year. And then you're kind of scrambling for races now. It wasn't a lot of indoor opportunities because now the colleges have totally eliminated us. You know, they're like, we're just trying to survive with our own COVID protocols. We can't have all these randoms now showing up and risk the event totally being wiped out. So that has kind of changed for us a little bit too, is that a lot of the opportunities that we did have, thanks to the college system, is really not available as much as it has been in the past. So that's what I think right now going into the Olympic trials is just try to get as many races as possible so that you can feel by the time we get to the trials, you're 100% comfortable with where you are and you've ran enough races to know. Because if you run races that don't go well, you have an opportunity to evaluate that and then get some other races in that end up do going well right before you go into the trials. Because no one wants to go into Olympic trials without a very high level of confidence. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is one thing that I will say, you must be super confident if, you know, when you're going into the Olympic trials, you cannot at any point be second guessing yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know if a person has ever made the team that way, especially not the U.S. Mm-hmm. Olympic team.
So how do you instill that into your athletes, the current ones that you have now?
Well, again, that is difficult because everybody is at a different level in their, you know, their level of confidence, right? I mean, the only thing that I can do is convince them that they're ready, but they got to believe it. So, like I said, we try to do as much in training. I try to convince them as much in training that they are where they need to be. And then we're going to start racing. But we haven't really raced a lot yet. So that we haven't even gotten to that point. And then I have some new athletes that, you know, last year started working with me in COVID and we didn't get a lot of races last year either. So, you know, so, yeah, it's tough. But again, we'll be ready when it's time.
Mm-hmm. I've been pretty impressed by the athletes who have gotten a chance to compete, even though it's limited opportunities. It seems like a lot of folks are still running fast and breaking records and running PRs. So it's like, it's been so hard for everybody, but when they're getting the chance to compete, they're taking advantage of it. And, you know, I kind of like to see that at least. It's like,
well, you know what I think that is? I think that is when something is taken away from you.
Yeah.
Then you realize how important it is. So you have this group of people who were relieved that there was no Olympic trials, Olympic games. And then you have another group that said, wow, you know, now I realize how much I love what I'm doing.
Yeah, I miss it. So,
a relieved group?
If you didn't miss it, you should have already quit.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, exactly. If you didn't miss it, you should have already. This should not be something that you feel forced to do, whether it be, you know, because you have a contract or, you know, for whatever reason, my family wants me to do it or whatever. It has to be a top priority and it has to be super important to you. Meaning when no one is watching, you're working, whether it's you're watching videos of yourself, old videos of yourself, videos of your competitors, working on your nutrition, you know, general strength, anything that you can be doing when you're not at practice and when you're not in front of your coach that you can do that is going to help you be a better athlete. Mm-hmm. If other things are more important, you're not going to be doing those things and you're going to fall behind.
Absolutely. Now I tell my athletes,
I want to go back a little bit because we skipped over some of your Olympic accomplishments. So the first time in 92, you made the Olympic team as a college athlete. And then in 96, you also made the Olympic team. But even before this 96 Olympics, you went into the 95 World Championships. What were your mental change between being a college athlete at the Olympic stage and be going into your world championships?
So 92 and 93 was my senior year. So that's when I kind of finished college. I did make the world team that year. I was fifth place at world coming out of my senior year. The next year was, and it was actually a world record race too. Mm-hmm. So in 93, Sandra Farmer Patrick and Sally Gunnell broke the world record in the race that I was in. And it looked like they were like 10 hurdles ahead, and they were like 10 hurdles on the track. So, so when you're in a race that fast, you're like, ooh, I need to step my game up. I was pretty young and all that, but I'm like, okay, these ladies are running 52 seconds pretty regular. Well, not regularly, but you know, just to see it and to be involved. And it's like, okay, you know, gotta get ready to be at that level.
Yeah.
94 came around and I really was not as focused that year. It was kind of an off year, no championships. And I had gotten grossly out of shape and then started kind of thinking like, I'm going to go into 95 and really, really, really hammer it. I'm going to do all the things that I haven't done in the past that and really see where I can take myself in this sport. And if not, then I need to be doing something different. So I actually went into 96 way before that race with a different mentality. I was on that level where I was going to do really well or I was going to quit and not do it. Mm-hmm. Okay, I had my mind made up. It was pretty simple. So I really did go into that fall like saying, I'm going to make this happen or I'm going to do something different. So it was the one time that I really had that different mentality of work ethic. I did say in 92 that I had lost a lot of weight. So that was the one thing I did work on, but I didn't work on a lot of the other things too that I had mentioned earlier. But so I went into 95 with a really great mindset of how hard that I needed to work. And I got married at the end of 95, but my husband who was my fiance at the time, he was playing in the NFL and he was super, super, super motivated as he always is. And I would be eating stuff and he's like, why are you eating that?
Uh-huh.
I'm like, what? Chicken wings? You know,
I can't get any wings.
And run the way you run. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'm going to get a little bit more focused here. So he really did help me a lot to be like, this is what elite level athletes do. Okay. Cause I had just gotten away with being talented for so long that it was a different way of thinking that I didn't even know that I needed to adjust to. So, but yeah, so going into 95, I was even the first race out was a really good race for me in that it was one of my fastest openers. So I'm like, okay, I'm on the right track here. Went to Pan Ams, ran well there. And then by the time I got to Gothenburg, there was not one single doubt in my mind that I was gonna lose. Like none. Like I would have bet the bank on every single thing that I had that I was gonna win. Not even getting on the plane to go there, but definitely by the time I've gone through the call room and we're all sitting there putting on our spikes and I'm looking around and I'm like, I think I can beat every single one of these chicks. I'm like, okay, yeah, it's about to be. I mean, it was done. It was a done deal. And so when I lost, immediately I was super, super disappointed and devastated. And then when Kim ran over to me and was like, look at the clock. And I looked at it and I was like, it didn't even register in my head. I was like, what is this clock saying? Like, it didn't even make sense to me. And I was like, oh, like we ran really fast, right? And so I was like, okay, all right, I'm cool. And then afterwards, leaving that competition, going to Zurich, which was the next meet, like days later, they were dismissing me. And in my mind, I was like, oh, this race wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for me and her. Like we both pushed, but that was the first time in my, as an athlete, that I realized it is about winning and losing. Okay. Don't be fooled. It is definitely about winning and losing. Okay. Yeah. And that's not to say that, you know, if you don't feel like you can win, don't try. But I'm going to tell you, you're going to get your feelings hurt if you think that they interview second and third place winners. Let me just let you know that.
It doesn't even matter if you just broke the world record or not. You can't.
No, they don't care. Nobody cares. You did not win. You lost. Mm-hmm. but it was cool. And, you know, it was so funny. I'll tell you a secret. So after the race was over and everything had calmed down, I actually requested to see the FAT time, you know, like the whole, the timing. Cause I was like, you know, like, I don't want them to come back an hour later and be like, you know, we made a mistake. Because I'm telling you, my PR before that meet was 53.6. I ran a whole second faster, but I'm telling you, it was the mentality. And that's why I try to tell people, don't worry about the times, because if your main mission is to win, the time is going to come.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're
preparing for that race, trying to win. You just went into that race trying to win. And over those 10 barriers, you didn't think that, yo, I'm on a really fast pace.
No. That's why I'm trying to be very clear about this. I did not care about anything but winning. I don't care if we had ran 55 seconds. I would have been
wanted that win.
As ecstatic because I won. All I cared about was win. I did not care about stride pattern, stride rhythm, what leg I was going over. Nothing. No, nothing. I was coming off of hurdles and I was seeing another body and I'm like, okay, this body is too close. This body, why am I not shaking this body off? Because she was right there and I'm coming down the straightaway and I just could not shake her. I was doing everything in my power to shake her and she was there and she wasn't going anywhere. So, and that's the whole point, because it was still just about trying to do everything possible to win. And that's where the fast times come. You know, when you stop worrying about, you know, where am I at in this point of the race? Am I running faster? A lot of athletes quit because they don't feel like they're running. They have this thing in their mind where today I'm ready to run this PR, right? Hey, I'm trying to run this PR. I'm trying to run this thing. And you can feel and tell at a certain point in the race that you're not meeting that goal, quit.
Yeah. And then you just like bail.
You bail. Now in the moment, when I look back at the race, yeah, I was moving pretty fast and I knew it. Right. But in the moment, no, it had nothing to do with it. I was trying to make sure that I was the first person cross finish line. And I was judging myself off of the hurdles. I'm trying to touch down off hurdles before everybody else so that I can win. You see? So ultimately, as an athlete, that's what it has to be about. Because you can't control times anyway. You don't know if it's a headwind or a tailwind or, you know, conditions. You know, some of those races we ran at 11 o'clock at night in a foreign country, you know?
Yeah.
And the people in the stands, they like to see records broken, but they're coming to see the competition. Otherwise, you could have a exhibition with one person running in their own lane if you're just chasing times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Spectators watch the sport because they want to see people competing against each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just like any other sport, just like a basketball game. You want to see which team's going to win. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still in the competition. Now, okay, the stats later. Okay, what did this person score? How many rebounds? You know, all that's later. But at the time, They're in the moment of watching the game.
Mm-hmm. They're just worried about who's winning at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Say it again.
I said they just worried about who's winning at this moment. But now after you got second place, tell them what you did in Zurich.
Oh, so in Zurich, So in Zurich, I was pissed. I was really mad. So I was mad in Zurich because prior to Worlds, I don't know if you know Marie Jose Perec, but she's a really successful 400 meter runner. Mm-hmm. And she was being coached by John Smith at the time. And they were making a huge deal about her. She had started running 400 hurdles that year. And she had ran some good races, and she had run 53 low on one of the races. And so, or mid or something like that. So coming into Gothenburg, she had a really good time. And she was talking about how she was going to run the double. And so the attention kind of went away from the traditional 400 hurdlers to her, right? Mm-hmm. And so they were in this talking about, oh, she runs 48 and a quarter. So if any of the 400 hurdlers, meaning us, came off the last hurdle with her, we were dead meat. Mm-hmm. That was the theory, the theme. And they just kept saying this over and over and over. And as an athlete, who wants to be counted out? Nobody. So we was ready for her in Gothenburg. We was like, I hope she show up for Gothenburg. We ready. But then she didn't end up doing it. She ended up running the 400. But
there was this whole thing.
Oh, she's running Zurich now. And we were like, bring it on.
Exactly.
Yeah. But here's where I got pissed. So the whole draw up to this race in Zurich was Kim Batten and her again. So I'm like, okay, now I'm getting pissed. So I clearly remember going down the backstretch, and I was going so fast that my legs were spinning at a pace that I didn't feel comfortable with. So I actually, in the race, I backed off. I was like, nope, this is not right. I've done this too many times to know that this is not right. I've never trained at this pace. I've never competed at this pace. So I backed off the pace and they just went, right? So then about hurdle 8, I started feeling them come back to me because I was in tune enough to know I need to get back on my rhythm. So about hurdle 8, I started to feel them coming back to me. And then they were getting tired because they went out too hard. Mm-hmm. And so, funny enough, coming off the last hurdle, me and Perec touched down at the same time. And I was like, I'm about to tear this 48 up.
Yep, yep.
They will never say anything about my runoff off the last hurdle.
Nope.
So that was I ran 52.90. And so I was actually the first woman in history to run 50 more than once.
Oh.
Nice.
Yep. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Another accolade.
But again, it was motivation and wanting to win, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's again, the thing here.
You made an excellent point earlier that I want to highlight, because anytime I hear this, I want to highlight it. You know, you said you went into 95. It's like you made a decision. And I'm always saying that to folks, like, if you want to be successful, you have to actually make a decision on what you're going to do. And then every choice that you make, weigh it against that decision. And you said the main difference in that year, where you ran faster than the world record and ran a second faster, is that you made a decision that you were going to go and win, and you changed everything. You changed how you were doing things, eating and whatnot, so that it can fulfill that decision that you made. So I think that's important, because that's a big piece of it. You were already good. You were already talented. You were already winning, but you had to get to that next level. You had to stop and make a choice.
Yeah, there was a lot of pieces that I had not had in the puzzle yet, though, you know. And I'm going to tell you, it's as serious as I was leaving Europe that year in 94. And I wrote a list. I wrote a list of things that I needed to change.
There we go.
In my life, that like a top 5 list. And I don't even know if it was in any order, but I do remember writing this list of I'm getting rid of this. I'm getting rid of this. I'm getting rid of this. And some of them were people. And
this list
were a distraction for me. Included people who were a distraction to me.
No, that's why I wanted you to emphasize that. So people as well.
I think the list was mainly people.
So you find that people were a big distraction when it came to trying to pursue your goals and track.
Yeah, sir.
Were they intentionally?
For sure.
Do you think that this was intentional, or it's just how they were living their lives? It didn't mesh with what you were trying to do.
Nope. Yeah, mainly that. A couple of them just had their business and my business, and it wasn't helping them, and it certainly wasn't helping me.
Yeah.
And so, so that was that was stuff. I was like, this isn't going to help me, and I don't see that it's bringing any positivity to me. So I'm cool just getting rid of this, and this, and moving on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you seen that as a coach? Negative influences on your athletes from other kids that you coach? Like, there's just, you can see that this kid could be good.
Worse now because, you know, y'all got social media.
Oh, yeah.
So when a person wants to be a distraction, because sometimes it is intentional, and sometimes people just think they know everything, so they want to be the knower of all he or she surveys, so they want to give you their opinion. And if you listen, then they feel great because they feel like that they're all powerful and knowing, right? Mm-hmm. And usually people do not approach you unless you look and act vulnerable, right?
Mm.
Nobody is going to hit you up if you are confident in what you're doing, you look confident, and you trust in the people you're around, okay? Mm-hmm. People hit you up when they think, oh, this person looks a little vulnerable. They'll probably listen to everything I got to say, right?
Yeah.
And then when you can't find people, they'll try to find you through social media or other people around you and start getting in your head. And next thing you know, you believe in some hogwash you shouldn't be believing. And then there's the distraction. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then they're showing up in the form of, I'm here trying to help you. Mm-hmm. So that is what I see in track a lot, is that you have to have a core group of people. And when I say group, that could mean two people that you listen to, that you get your advice from. The person at the top of the list needs to be your coach. And if you are doubting your coach or you're second guessing what your coach is doing, you are in a world of trouble.
Oh, I'll say it again. Say it again.
If you are doubting your coach, or you got somebody else in your ear talking to you about what your coach should only be talking to you about, you are already in trouble. Okay? Because the coach does not have to go out and compete. When it comes down to it, it's all you. So I always say, even with my coach, it didn't matter what my coach told me. I never took a second to say first, does this man know what he's talking about? Before I decided to do it. It's just when he told me it, that was it. This is what I'm going to do. This is obviously what's important for what he sees. When I ran fast, I was shocked. Remember I said I needed to go look at the
FAT. Yeah.
He wasn't surprised.
Of course not.
Look, did you see what I ran? He was like, uh-huh. And, you know...
I still have kids who.
Did you think I could ever do that?
Yeah,
absolutely. Do you know how many coaches hit me up after that saying, "Hey, maybe you should come and move here, and you did that in Illinois in the cold. Imagine how much faster you can run it if you come to me." And having their athletes try to talk to me, convince me to make a move, and convince me to do this, and well, look who you can be training with. You can come. All of these different suggestions of what I now needed to go do to be even better than I already was. And, you know, it just, that was never going to be me. You know, it was just never going to be me. So it was pretty easy for me because I wholeheartedly believed every single thing that my coach told me. And I also believed that he had my best interest at heart. So there was no reason, even if my coach made a mistake, then I knew he didn't mean to make the mistake. It was what he best knew at the time, right? Yeah. And we were in it together, okay? So I'll give you an example. In 96, I was running really, really fast because I had really worked on my speed that year. I was really working on getting just faster, right? And so we went, they had this meet in Atlanta, the Grand Prix Invitational before the trials, and it was that track. track that we ran the trial. We ended up running the trials on, and then later the Olympics. But it was a brand new track. It was a baseball stadium. They laid the track down. I personally believe that that surface was crazy, meaning like I think it had a very concrete with a thin layer of surface over top. that mug is fat.
Yeah, it's fast.
It's all bounce, boy. It's all bounce.
You don't want to train on it. You don't want to train on it, but you're going to run something.
No. Not only that, you know they tore that track up right after we ran in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, they peeled that mug up quick. Like, let's get this. So I was going to second guess the invitation. I could not run on that track. Like, I was like, I couldn't get my stride pattern together. I was chopping. I was getting to the hurdle too. I was like, this track is going to be so hard for me to run on. So, come back. I was telling my coach, you know, he's watching. He's like, what are you doing? I'm all over the place. Then we go down to the trials and it's literally the same thing. Like I'm chopping because I had this stride pattern where I run 15, 16 and come home on 17, right? So trying to take 17 steps between the last two hurdles with that much velocity was tough. So we talked about it and he was like, I think you can come 16 home, which I had never done before, right? So we trained for it, all going to Atlanta, and that's what I did. I mean, I ended up doing it in the race, but in hindsight, I just didn't have the same kind of rhythm that I normally had. So when I wanted to change gears, I had these longer strides, and then even one of them, like 9, I came off balance because I was hurdling with my unpreferred and, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So in hindsight, I could be sitting here going, man, I don't know why he had me, you know, but what we were dealing with, and at the time, I was like, yeah, this is what we doing, right? Mm-hmm. And we gonna win together or we gonna lose together.
Yep, you know? That's right.
So
I love it.
No, we gonna win together or we gonna lose together. We a team. So so even to this day, like I don't ever remember one time that I ever questioned what my coach wanted me to do in training, competing, anything.
Wonderful.
One thing that you were talking about when you had said that you were taking out distractions and you shouldn't be afraid to eliminate people, that draws me to one of the things that you told me as a coach. Well, as when I was your athlete, you said that success is like a pyramid, and the higher you get up, the less people that would be around you, and you could just be at the bottom with everyone else, or you can be striving to the top. So it's okay to be a bitch. And saying that wasn't about just like have an attitude or anything like that, but it's okay to say no. And it's okay to say, put yourself first. And even if you only have two friends around you at the time, just know that you're going to be successful with those two.
Hey, it's lonely at the top.
It's lonely at the top. It's very lonely at the top.
And you know, I tell you what, when I made the 92 team, and you know my personality, Ashley. So I come back, I'm a college kid. Everybody acting funny. I'm like, why is everybody acting funny? You know? So years later, as an adult, I ended up asking one of my teammates, I said, why was y'all tripping? And they was like, we thought you was going to be different. I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. So everybody like put their shield or armor on, like, oh, when she come back, she going to be thinking she all this. So you know what? I'm about to go on and put my suit of armor on. So, you know, and I'm like, yeah, y'all was kind of clowning. I don't know why all of a sudden everybody started acting like I was different. And they were like, nah, we just expect you to be different. So,
you know, start treating you different.
And I'm like, oh, okay, well, y'all was tripping. So I moved on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You didn't even dwell on it. You just moved on and you moved up.
Y'all was tripping. So I had to move on. But yeah, it is really lonely at the top. And I don't even only mean in, you know, just in associations, but things that, you know, you can't do what everybody else does. You can't go to all the parties that everybody goes to. You can't drink the alcohol that you have to surround yourself around people that have the same interests when you're an athlete, because, you know, it will be tough to maintain your lifestyle the way you need to, you know, like you don't see a lot of a group of single women and they got the one married lady. Nah, because they out trying to find a man.
Yeah, that married person don't need to be there.
It's still the same thing. You usually end up associating yourself with people who have like interests, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's the same when you're an athlete. You have to find people that have the same type of interests, or else you're going to find yourself doing things you really shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know we glanced over it. I know we glanced over it, but Ashley. That. We glanced over, but Ashley, you did get coached by Coach Tanja, right?
Yes, he was my college coach.
That's right.
She coached me to her All-American honors. And one thing that she also said is that at the beginning of each season, you have to make a decision. And the year when I was All-American in the 400, we sat down together and we made that decision. And she told me, listen, if you want to do this, yes, I'll be here and I'll check in on you. We'll make sure that we're on the path every week, but you have to make certain decisions for yourself. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you have to get your weight down. You have to kind of like not be following the crowd and everything like that. So those things that she has, the things that she's done to be successful in her career are some things that she instills in her athletes. And I think it's important to have a coach that, well, it's beneficial to have a coach that has been there because they can draw on those references. And it's easy because you believe like, okay, she's been here. So she knows exactly what she's talking about. So you can have your confidence in the coach that you're with. So yeah, so a lot of the things that she said that she had to do, I did that with her and I was successful because I followed that. I had to make my decision to be the person that I wanted to be or else it wasn't going to happen. And another thing that she said that I think a lot of athletes and a lot of the people that we already interviewed, they said that they had a make or break it year. Like when you went into 95, you said like, listen, I'm going to either give it my all and just be successful, or I'm just going to hang it up and find something else to do. And there's so many athletes that when they're on that edge of greatness, they make that decision. Like, listen, this is going to be either happen or not happen. So it's a trend with a lot of the guests that we've interviewed here.
Yeah, I would see athletes and I'm like, somebody just needs to tap him or her on the shoulder and tell them it's over. You know, I just didn't want that to ever be me, right? So I'm like, I'm going to do this for myself here, right? But Ashley, you mentioned it, but I'll tell you the thing with you two is, you know, when Ashley came to Illinois, she was young.
Yeah, I was a baby.
Baby. Very, very young compared to all the other freshmen when they come into school. And you had already had a job at home. You had already... you know, finished high school, I think even a year before that. So, you know, it was a maturity level too, where I could have that conversation with you and you could get it right away. You know, everybody doesn't have that maturity to be able to get it, you know, because it even took me, you know, some time for myself to understand some of the things that my coach was asking me to do. Even my freshman year with my weight and even into my sophomore year with my weight, I told you, like, I didn't even really do the weight thing until my junior year. Right.
Yeah.
So there was things that he was telling me that it still took me a while to like really catch on to say, I really need to get serious about this. So I think that is athlete to athlete too. And it just, you know, some people just can't receive it the way others can, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that can sometimes, I don't ever want to say it's a curse because it's never a curse to be talented and athletic, but at some point you have to get out of the way of how talented you are. Because we all know when you're on the playground or when you're a child in preschool, you know that you can do things that the other little kid can't do, right? Like you just know that. That's just boom. I can go hang on this thing and I'm gonna hang longer. I can do the flip, right? You know, yeah. you just know it, right? Because you can see it and you move better. You have more agility. You know, you can see an athletic kid, right? Yeah. So it starts there, and the more you go through the process of development, you always end up being the one that's at the top of the food chain, whether it's kickball or whatever. You know, so this is kind of something you get comfortable with. But you can get too comfortable to not figure out where do I really now draw the line in. I can't just rely on I have this ability and I have to do all these other things for it to work out, you know, because at the pro level, everybody's talented.
Yep.
Everybody. Now, still everybody has different levels of talent, but everybody is generally talented. Once you get to the college level, there are a lot of different levels of talent. But once you get to the pro level, everybody's talented. Mm-hmm. And so now it just really becomes this very small window of things that you have to do in order to really. And so it has to be so strict and so motivating and so intense at times. Like you can't really fall off the wagon at all. You don't have time to.
Yeah. So if you can name five characteristics that a successful athlete would have, that's if someone came up to you and be like, what are five things that you look for? What would those five things be?
I think the first thing has to be motivation. That's the top priority is motivation, because you have to be motivated to do all the things, right? So all the other list of 20 things, you've got to be motivated first to do that, right? And if you don't have that motivation to do that, and I'm talking about self-motivation, not somebody pushing you, not somebody urging you, encouraging you, just really being like, oh my, this is something. You know how you act when you want something.
Yeah.
It has to be like, and you know how you act when you don't really want something, or it's okay if you don't get it. That's yeah. You have to be motivated. I think you also have to have that will to win, which I think is two totally different things. You know, we were talking about the will to win eliminates all the other little things that, you know, when you go into a race, it eliminates how fast am I going to run? What lane do I have? Who's in my race? Like, if I want to win, then I don't care about none of that other little stuff. Okay. I think you do have to have a good core of people around you that have the same interest that you do, whether it be training partners, coach, family. They all have to be a positive influence, you know, on what you're doing. You definitely have to have a plan. So that would be number four, is having a plan. Like, what is my goal at the end of this when this is all said and done? Right. Because that's where the motivation comes in. What am I motivated to do? Am I motivated to make the team? Am I motivated to get a medal? Am I motivated to make some money this year? Like, what is your motivation for even doing this? So you have to have a plan, right? So that when you get to the end, you're like, well, did I reach my goal? Right. And then I think finally just focus. You got to be so in tune with the path. And then that way you will eliminate all distractions, but you have to be super motivated.
Wow. Nice.
And so I had a question for you with, you know, we talked about a little bit of everything, but obviously we covered your very successful career as an athlete, but you've done some amazing things as a coach as well. And, you know, there are a lot of young coaches, you know, like I said, I volunteered at Illinois when you were there, a lot of young coaches who kind of want to get in the game, a lot of young female coaches who want to get in the game and move up in the ranks and get these positions. What advice do you have for coaches who are trying to become, who are trying to model you, who are trying to become championship coaches and you know, create national champions and all Americans and all of that?
Well, it helps to get in. When I came into the sport as a coach, I came in under my coach. So we started out where he was like, I'm going to teach you everything you need to know about being a coach. Right. So, that it was a process. It was 3 years before I got my own group. Right. And so it was, they used to call me the clipboard girl, you know, people who was jealous. They would call me the clipboard girl. Oh, she's just walking around Gary's clipboard. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm learning. So in a couple of years, watch out for me because I'm figuring this thing out. So he would tell me, like, I would have to stand around for the shot put, high jump, pole vault, the throwing events. Like, it was a single gender program. So you have three coaches in all the events. So I learned all the events. I understood all events. And he said, you know, one day when you become a head coach, if your throws coach get hit by a bus on the way to the track meet, you're going to need to coach your team. Mm-hmm. I'm like, because it's your team, right? So So that was, those were things that it took, it was years for me to learn before I actually start. And then I started working on understanding how to do an entire program and how you start at the fall season and how it morphs into what you want to see at the end of the year. So that by the time you're in June at the NCAA championships, you're getting the result that you intended to get. Right. Instead of you see like these athletes running really fast, the first one or two races, and then they're either injured or running slow or nowhere to be seen. And ultimately in our sport, nothing matters other than the outdoor NCAA championships, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's cool who wins indoor, but ultimately that's where all the shoe companies sitting around waiting to see who they're going to sign contracts for. And that's where the teams that you make, it's all in June. None of that stuff is happening in March. Okay. Maybe rare few here or there people, but for the most part, you know, it is a long, long process, and you need to have the athletes ready when it matters, right? And that's tough because their athletes are seeing people pop times and they're like, why aren't we running fast like that? And I'm like, because you're going to have to call their coach and ask them what their plan was, because their plan might have been the indoor national meet. Maybe that's, and I'm not saying that's a bad plan. That's just their plan, right? That's not my plan. That's not our plan. Oh. So it's hard to keep athletes continuing to stay focused and focusing on what that the real plan is, which is, you know, months and months away. So I learned all those kind of things. I learned how to manage athletes from start to finish and that kind of thing. I always enjoyed the recruiting side of it. But I think it's important to get under a mentorship and have a couple of coaches that you really can ask questions to. And I mean questions that are saying, I don't know what I'm doing here. Help me.
Yeah.
Right. Instead of going and thinking you know, I was a good athlete, so I should know how to coach this track thing, because it's two totally different things. Right.
Oh yeah.
You know, it was crazy because when I started coaching, I realized how much I didn't even know about the team that I was on. Right. So the team that I was on, I focused on me, the people that was on my relay, and a couple, like, I didn't know that there was this humongous different level of all these different athletes there for different reasons. Some people were just happy to have a scholarship. Some people were walk-ons. Some people just wanted to be a part of, you know, this whole system. Like, you can have a team of 50 women and every single person on the team has a different reason for why they're there. Right. Mm-hmm. And until I started to coach, I'd never even realized that, you know. So that's a lot to manage and to understand and, you know, to figure out how that works. So the coaching side of it is not just the performance you see on the track. It's a lot behind the scenes. It's a lot of behind the scenes stuff. And then ultimately, I know for me, the greatest years of my life was when I was in college. I had so much fun. I picked the right school. I picked the right coach. It was just fun. I just can't even tell you how much I enjoyed college. And I always just wanted everybody else to experience the same thing. It's like, these are going to be the greatest years of your life. So enjoy it. So I never liked to see people not enjoying that period, because I feel like it only goes downhill from there.
So as a college coach, make sure your athletes are enjoying their experience. Learn your craft, make sure your athletes are enjoying your experience, and find a mentor, and then also know that there's a lot to manage.
Mm-hmm. You can't make it so difficult that nobody's having any fun. Not at that level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's
great advice, because I mean, it means a lot. You've done it. And I know a lot of folks are trying to get in the game, and that's great advice. Finding a mentor, learning your craft, getting good at it. You know, I always tell people to go volunteer, go to a good program and learn. And also, you get your foot in the door by volunteering, because you volunteer for a year or two. Now you have an opportunity to actually get an assistant job somewhere.
Absolutely. And if you're volunteering under the right person, and person can refer you you can end up really in a good spot. And I've had a lot of experiences with people that have volunteered for me where I have talked to a head coach and said, what you're looking for is not what you need, but this person can actually give you what you need. Okay. And mm-hmm. and a lot of times, you know, head coaches will look like, it'd be really cool to have an alumni in this area, or it'd be really cool to have this. And I'm like, nah, you actually need somebody to help you recruit. So this person's gonna help you. This person's gonna help you get the talent there, and then you can figure the other stuff out, you know, or this person is, you know, I try to make sure I always had people that I felt like were smarter than me around me, right? So like a bunch of degrees and smart and together. You know, love their family. And if I forgot something, they're the first one telling me, hey, coach, remember, we got to do this. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay, cool. Hey, remember, the deadline for this is this day. Oh, great. Like, there's a million things that you have to do as a head coach. And if you don't have good assistants who have your back and are going to make sure that you always look good, then I never hired anybody that was like a friend of mine that I had already known, because that wasn't what it was about. I'm like, I want really smart professional people who, you know, when it comes down to it, them having their job is as important as me having my job. So, you know, I never had assistant coaches where I had to say, hey, why haven't you come to work today? Or why are you late? Or you're not doing this with your athletes? Or, you know, why are y'all having so many off days? Or, you know, or second guessing anything that my assistants were doing. They were always on top of their game. So all the other stuff about how they were dressed and all that, you know, like these coaches would be like, I want everybody to be matching. Or I was like, I don't care about that. You know, are the athletes performing the way they need to be performing? I don't care if I'm matching the track meet, you know? So, you know, and then again, ultimately, we end up having fun. Actually, remember when we did that talent show?
Yeah, Jock Jams. First one. No, you were in the one that we won. Yeah, Coach Sandra is definitely a team sport. We did Michael Jackson, and she was like the date at the beginning. You know when Michael Jackson had Thriller, he had a date in the video.
Yeah.
So she's definitely a team.
I can't dance, player. So I was like, okay, what I will do is I'll walk out. And I'll scream and I'll run off stage.
So she's definitely
it was
down.
So cute. They had this whole thing down. We were like practicing in the locker room. It was so fun.
Yeah. So we definitely had the time in our life for those years. But we talked about your career as an athlete, career as a coach. What are you doing now?
Coaching professionals now. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I have 7 young ladies that I coach. All Olympic level, getting ready for the trials. We compete in 2 weeks at Texas Relays. We had a few indoor competitions that it was the American Track League meets in Arkansas. So that was cool. And now we're just getting ready for outdoor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of the name of your club.
USA Track and Fields put some meets together for us. So it's going to work out. So we're happy to just be able to get back on track and compete.
Yeah. Tell us the name of your club and where we can follow you.
Okay. So it's the Buford Bailey Track Club. I do have social media outlets, but I really am not as active as I need to be. So I really do mainly stuff on my personal, which is at Bailey Tanja. That's my Twitter and Instagram. So you'll see every now and then we'll put stuff on there from practice and stuff like that. But I do need to be a little bit more active with the club social media outlets.
Yes. And you can find her shirts on the at Bailey Tanja and the Buford Bailey Chat Club social media. So
yeah, I have a link on my site.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Coach, I love how you think, your philosophy, even since, you know, when you were younger, it was all no pressure. It's like you make it fun, or you're having fun with it. And even the environment that it sounds like you create for your athletes, it sounds like it's fun. And you know, that goes a long way, taking the pressure off of folks so they can go out there and just perform and enjoy it. So now that sounds great. think a lot of us can learn a lesson from you about that and trying to make some of this stuff fun again and remove a little bit of the pressure. So I appreciate you coming on and chatting with us, sharing your story with us. You know, it's just so much that you've done. And, you know, I appreciate you taking the time to go over it with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining our conversation.
Yeah.
Thanks, absolutely. Ashley. It's great to see you. When are you competing?
This weekend in Miami. Miami.
Are you going to compete April 10th? I think they have a meet Miramar on April 10th.
Yes, supposed to. I'm supposed to actually open up in the 400 there.
Oh, yeah.
Allegedly. Okay. We'll see.
We'll see. Yeah. All right. Well, good. Thank you.
Appreciate it, coach. Have a good one. Have a great rest of your year. Night. Good luck this season.
I'll be in Houston next week, so we'll probably link up.
You say you'll be where?
In Houston next week, so we'll probably be able to link up.
Yeah, for the weekend?
Yeah, Prairie View?
No, that's the third. Oh, no, there is Prairie View Relays, right? That's the same weekend as... No, we're going to go Texas Relays that weekend because it's just down the street from us. This is so much easier. And I have alumni that... went to UT, so they want to run at home. So that's cool.
That's great.
Yep. All right. We'll see you. Bye. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.